I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. Tuesday evenings, as I think most of you know, is an ongoing lecture series. I want to report that next week we're going to take a break from Tuesday evenings for in observance of Passover, and we will be back on the following Tuesday, April 2nd, with the artist Trenton Doyle Hancock, who will be here to present in preparation of the Bring Back, which is the title of his talk, in which he is going to share a new direction in his work. Having moved from his signature narrative of the beloved mound and vegans, which most of you are familiar with the piece upstairs, he has now moved on to a much more personal exploration, and he's been kind enough to agree to come and share that with us. Tonight, Matthew Collins has joined us as he is here from the UK with his partner and wife, Emma Biggs, for an exhibition titled Suspicious Utopias, which opens this coming Saturday at Fort Worth Contemporary Arts, which I think you all know is at the edge of TCU campus off of Berry Street. So I hope you'll make it for that. And just another note, Matthew is also going to be speaking tomorrow for students at TWU, which I think is open if anybody's in that neck of the woods, to stop by and hear that. And he's also going to be presenting his ideas at the Nasher on Thursday evening. So there's a lot of Matthew to go around this visit. Christina Reese is keeping him very, very busy. I wanted to give you a little information on Matthew. He studied painting at Byam Shaw Art School and Goldsmiths. While continuously making art, Matthew is an artist with much to say, much to offer. So after graduating from art school, he began writing reviews, which has led to a long and illustrious career as a writer, critic, and I guess you might say broadcaster, renowned commentator and spokesperson for art. Before going to Goldsmiths, he was the editor of Art Scribe from 1983 to 87, and shortly after leaving Goldsmiths, he produced and presented The Late Show on BBC Two, 1989 to 95, which I understand had an enormous following. He went on to write and present his closely followed TV series, This is Modern Art, which won him a BAFTA in 1998, in addition to other awards in recognition of that program, and which also became a book by the same title in 1999. Matthew was also, for many years, the official voice of Britain's Channel 4 live coverage of the Turner Prize. In 2003, he wrote and presented a television program on old master painting titled Matt's Old Masters, which has become a book by the same title as well. And he also did series such as, and I love these titles, they give you a little insight into his quick wit, Impressionism, Revenge of the Nice in 2004, and The Me Generations, plural, Self-Portraits from 2005. In addition to broadcasting, reviews, lecturing, and participating on numerous panels, Matthew is a prolific writer, having authored books such as those mentioned, and Blimey, From Bohemia to Britpop, London After, Art World, From Francis Bacon to Damien Hirst, as well as It Hurts, New York Art from Warhol to Now, also Art Crazy Nation, This is Civilization, A Future for Modernism, and more, which I don't have time to mention tonight. But I have to say that Matthew and Emma have a beautiful website that I would invite you to visit that can fill you in on what I'm not able to tell you tonight because of the brevity of this introduction. Perhaps my favorite endeavor, I have to say, as I've been reading about Matthew, as a commentator anyway, is his monthly column in Art Review, called Great Critics and Their Ideas, for which he interviews historical figures to attain their perspective on current states of affairs. It's brilliant, hilarious. Like most of Matthew's work, they are historically sound and presently profound. I really invite you to look those up if you're not familiar with them. In 2001, Matthew Collings and Emma Biggs, a mosaic artist of more than 25 years, began their collaborative work as Biggs and Collings. The couple's system-based paintings about light have been widely exhibited. Most recently, there was their solo exhibition this past year titled The Whole Earth at Vigo Gallery, where their work is represented in London. Also, London 12 last summer at City Art Gallery in Prague. A group exhibition, Ha Ha, What Does This Represent? At Standpoint Gallery in London, and the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition, also in 2012. In addition, in 2007, Emma and Matthew co-curated an exhibition of Picasso's late works. Tonight, Matthew has promised an evening of aesthetic intensity and lurid biography, his words, as he shares the peculiar life experiences that fed into his and Emma's optimistic abstract paintings, which stand in stark contrast with the acute and uncompromising look he takes as a writer and commentator, but are nevertheless being made with the conviction that, quote, art as it used to be understood has come to an end. Please join me in welcoming Matthew Collings.
Thank you very much, Terry, and thank you all for coming tonight. I'm going to be talking about my work with Emma, which we started exhibiting in the year that Terry mentioned, but we actually started working on it a few years before, so our joint practice has been going on for about 15 years now. I'm going to be talking really about the heart of the concerns of that work. And it's a work that's about a very specific type of thing. It's about really just colour relationships and arranging colours so that they do something, which sounds as if it's not much, but we hope that it will have a sort of resonance and will make a difference. But I'm also going to attempt to talk more or less simultaneously, or at least back and forth, about something that's engaged me perhaps far longer than those works, and that is the concept of an art scene. What is one, and how do they come about? What is required for one? Why was there one in London in the late 80s? Why did one begin there when there hadn't really been one before? Why do they pop up in certain places and then die away again? And it's not that I have a sort of sociological facts or financial facts or a lot of sound historical analysis to explain this phenomenon. The insights I'm going to offer are just my personal, they come from my personal experience, where I've seen the chancy and unpredictable and eccentric paths by which a scene gets established. And I recognize in that, because it's been my job a lot, for one reason or another, in the sort of the journalism side of my career, it's been my job to sort of comment on the scene. So I've drawn some conclusions and had some insights about what goes into them. And I recognize something of the same patterns in the formation of the joint practice that I do with them, our private artistic thing that we do in the studio that is about a sort of intense expression, if you like, that only art can do. There seems to be some similarity between how the sort of shaky structures that led to that becoming a workable, viable operation. There seems to be some similarity between those shaky structures and the much bigger picture. And from, I'm going to take really as my example, the formation of the Young British Artists, which in some ways is a boring subject now because its moment is past. That's one of the reasons it's a bit boring. And the other reason it's maybe a bit boring in that as a model, it sort of has repeated in so many places around the world since the late 80s when it took off, that we're so used to it that it doesn't really seem like anything. That combination of circumstances, maybe the country is in a certain state, the economy is in a certain state. There's an art school that has a certain brightness and energy about it. There's a few individuals that are lively and enthusiastic. Or maybe they have a touch of cynicism as well that enables them to see what needs to be seen to make something happen. And also they maybe have a rather knowing, and an attitude that is both enthusiastic but also maybe jaded and knowing about art history and what the competition is, who they're having to, you know, what the makeup of the established setup for art is. They have an intuition about that, even though they're only age 19 or 20 or something. They have an intuition of how they could make their own mark. And their route to achieving making their mark might have elements of clownishness about it. Or youthful vulnerability, and yet somehow it comes off. So from something very unlikely comes something so formidable and successful that it almost seems like it's been there for much longer than it really has. And so it becomes natural rather than you're constantly aware of its construction, rather than you seeing the seams and how it's held together and feeling it could fall apart at any moment. You feel like, oh gosh, this is the way art always has been and probably always will be. And perhaps always art was about shocking or breaking taboos or compelling attention by sort of certain ruses and leaving out certain things and emphasizing other things. Whereas anyone familiar enough with the history of culture and of art will know that art is always remaking itself and becoming something almost unrecognizable to what was acknowledged to be the what art should be and the systems that made art be important or worth having, say, 50 years or 100 years earlier. So the first image I'm going to show you is a detail of a painting by us. And I'd like you to think about this concept of multiplying rhythms when you see the image, which I'm hoping would appear when I press this arrow, but it seems to want to not show itself. So I don't know why that would be. Maybe I should point this at the screen instead of up there. Yeah. It worked so well, it sort of made me overconfident. I wasn't ready for a blow like this. I could do the talk without the pictures. Oh, there it is, yeah.
Is it?
Well, it was there, yeah. Oh, shall I just call out to you to do them, John? Okay, yeah. You're looking at something which in real life is probably about 15 inches across. That's a detail. The whole painting is 60 inches square. You're looking at a detail of about 15 inches of that painting. And the painting shows you nothing but a really quite dumb grid. A square canvas is divided horizontally and vertically and then diagonally. Left and top left to bottom right, top right to bottom left. So the grid communicates nothing, it simply divides up the canvas. And then Emma and I, over a very long period, proceed to establish some colours within those bounded areas. And we're looking for an end result where there is no fixed pattern, and yet you feel that there's an authority to the painting, a visual authority. You might find a certain configuration, say the yellows in the picture. They seem to arrange themselves in a way that's kind of pleasing. You can't quite predict when one's going to appear next, but it'll appear roughly in that area. Or you might pick out a blue-grey. Or you might pick out the colours that are intense, or you might pick out the colours that are muted. And at first it seems as though you've got a sort of harlequin pattern of sharp colours floating on a grey ground. But then you realise that what would be, say, the foreground shapes on the background
are actually themselves often grey.
So the only law of sharpness and not sharpness is that the background tends not to have any sharp colours, and the foreground, if you want to call it that, say we're calling the diamonds the foreground. The diamonds are sometimes entirely quite sharp high colours, and sometimes they're just half a sharp high colour. Every unit that you see is divided into a lighter and a darker version of colour. So you've got colour and tone, colour and light and dark. And you've got muted colours and sharp high colours. So that's a very narrow range of contents that the painting is offering. And then there's this other content, which is arrangement. So the painting, I'm calling it the painting in this sort of objective way, as if it is an us, but what we've got to do is make that painting be doing all the work itself, so you don't need to hear anything about us. The painting presents an arrangement, and it's as if arrangement itself, arrangement as an ideal, is the theme. How can arrangement be compelling enough that it makes you want to keep looking, and every time you come back to the painting, of which you're now seeing only a small detail, you see something slightly different. So the painting is capable, basically, of endless reinterpretation. And if you think about any painting from any period in art that has some kind of substantial impact, one of the things that one would hope about it is that it is capable of endless reinterpretation. And what tends to be the failure of work that is less interesting is that it has a sort of one-liner content. It sort of tells you what it is and that's it, and there isn't really anywhere else for it to go. So if you want anything more from it, that probably isn't the type of work you want. What one would always say about, say, you know, a painted by Piero della Francesca or some sort of invulnerable highlight of art historical art that everyone agrees is a magnificent moment. Although there are limitations to what Piero is doing, so he's got a lovely painting, some biblical character is being baptized, Jesus, John the Baptist baptizing Jesus by the River Jordan, there's some angels, there's Jerusalem in the background, and Piero paints his own hometown as Jerusalem. Everything in the picture seems to have its own geometric place. The spaces between the angels and the tree and the River Jordan, spaces between the little trees on the hill in the background, the spaces between the faces of Jesus and John the Baptist, the little tiny space between the top of Jesus' head and the dish that John the Baptist is holding over his head, the little silvery trickle of water is coming up. All those empty spaces are as active and dynamic and fascinating and compelling as every single object in the painting. So a beautifully painted face or a beautifully rendered outline of an arm and the volume of the body of Christ, those things are compelling and fascinating. But emptiness is just as fascinating, because he's constructing all those images out of what are essentially purely abstract values. Organization, space, arrangement, geometry. It's got a symbolic scene he wants to show you. To do honor to that scene, he's giving it the most visual impact and power that he can. He gets that from the traditions of art that he's familiar with, and he gets it from his own original tweaking of those traditions. What he's learnt and what he can offer, given the circumstances of his time. But essentially, you're looking at something rather abstract. And the reason you come back again and again to that painting in the National Gallery in London, if you've seen it, why it's always worth looking at it again, is not the Bible or the holiness of the picture, but in a way, if you can put it like this, it's the honour that he's doing to the Bible and the holiness via his concept, his abstract concept of how he's going to give that stuff visual impact. So the Bible is great, but the Bible doesn't really have that much
going for it in terms of detailed imagery. It has very, very stark images, and it's very good at presenting very stark symbolic images. But there's nothing like the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of visual details that exist in that painting. Not just the details of imagery, but also the details of space and handling and light and the way something might be sharply rendered and something more mistily rendered. So you've got a play of contrasts of the how something is done that gives the thing its richness, as well as what it is that's being presented. So I'm kind of painting for you a word picture of a painting that some of you may not have seen, some of you have seen, many of you probably know from reproductions. But what I'm talking about is an ideal of visual impact in art. And what we're doing with our purely abstract paintings, where everything is reduced to such a narrow set of concerns, mere diamond shapes divided into light and dark and into sharp and hazy colours, what we're doing is reinventing those visual impacts that occur throughout the history of visual art. We're reinventing it in terms of a purely abstract picture. Can we have the next picture, please? That's a wider detail of the same painting. So you see that the thing multiplies and multiplies and multiplies. And you see a recurrence of one or two or three or four or five quite strong and sharp colours compared to a recurrence of many, many subtle greys that are sort of blue-grey or greeny-grey or browny-blacky-grey, sort of a ghostly range of colours, and then a rather sort of colours which, compared to the ghostly ones, seem quite bright. But if you saw any of those colours that look bright there on a piece of white paper, they would look rather muddy. They look bright because of the relationship to the other colours. Can we have the next one? Around us is a lot of countryside of Norfolk, where we live, and we're constantly checking out the sites out there for how colour and light are perceived in the real world. Since the job of our paintings is to present colour and light in a very formal and organised way, we're checking out how the randomness of colour and light in the physical objective world, which of course scientists and naturalists and great studiers of the objective world will tell you is not random at all. But we are not those, we're just artists. And we perceive the organisation of colour out there as, we think of it as something to do with perception. It's how we are ourselves organising it, that we need to see, we need to focus. And in a almost reduce the visual phenomena that we're offered in reality, like what I see out there with all your colours and what you're seeing here with me. You've got to reduce it in order to make sense of it. What art does is celebrate that reducing, but what simply living does is you've got to rationalise chaos, visual chaos, so that you can move about and recognise things and manoeuvre and move about in reality without getting hit in the face by a tree. Next one, or falling in one of the beautiful rivers around here. So you can see that there is a relationship with these photos, which are, they're not sort of studied scenes, you know, we haven't really framed them up particularly expertly. But you can see there is a relationship between a sort of glinty light in the photos and a corresponding but artificially generated sense of light that the paintings have. The paintings have a feeling of light sort of coming out from the inside of the painting. The photos are attempts to capture the way light is perceived in nature. And the next one, please. So you don't always have a heightened sense of nature when you're out in it. And it's, I think these photos are a little bit like you're on drugs, where you can stare at everything for an hour at a time because you see the veins in your hands and you see the amazing sort of fluorescence of everything, which when you're not on drugs is the banal, ordinary, objective reality. And in a way, it's the job of art to capture that drug experience, but do it in an infinitely sustainable way. It's not a blast that's a shock for a minute, but it's something that you can come back to and come back to and keep seeing and re-seeing, so that you're... The job of art is to present something like the pleasure. We've all had that sense of glinty light and the joyousness of it and the sort of uplift that light can give anybody. It's one of the most immediate emotional uplifts that we get in ordinary life, that of light, sudden light. What the kind of art that we're involved in doing, and we would say it's something that art often has been involved with in the past, has to formalise that experience so that pleasure is being constructed, and at the same time you're being alerted to its artificiality. So now I'm going to go on to the next picture, and this is a painting very similar to the one that I showed you details of, but it isn't in fact the same painting. And this shows you a painting during its making. So it's like you've got an X-ray vision into how the other one was made. They're made bit by bit, the paintings. So we put a colour in a certain place, then we put a colour in a certain other place, and we see what they're doing, then we put another colour. And so we gradually build them up until they're all sort of musically syncopating and rhythmically vibrating. Which takes a very long time. We have to keep changing them. We establish certain rhythms, then we break those up and establish more, and break those up and establish more. So there is, as I said, a sort of multiplication of rhythms. The rhythms start out very simple to begin with, and then they get more and more complicated. And I think of this as a very crude stage of work, and it remains crude almost until the last minute. The paintings look very vulnerable right up until the last minute, and then they look rather sort of dazzling when they're finished. And so we don't really like to show them pictures of them when they're being done, and we don't really like people to come to the studio when they're being done, because they don't really look like anything. And to me, I think that's what an art scene is like. That those involved in it have such a strong sense of the habits of their own mind and their own limitations that it's very hard for them to see that they might be contributing to the building of a scene. Whether they are the creators, or whether they're the collectors, or the people who run art schools, or museums, or the benefactors of the scene, or the producers of the scene. But certainly, it's the case when you're an artist, that the small thing that you are able to do, or want to do, or have done, you can't imagine often how that could make a difference to what appears to you to be a very fixed, authoritative, established social setup in which art takes place or culture is made. What would be the use of you in that? Let alone, you know, you can hardly say how you could even be accepted in that. Let alone that you might yourself create, be part of the creation of a scene. You yourself might create a scene as powerful as that established thing, and maybe better. Maybe something that established scene would be rather impressed by and want to change itself according to the thing that you had done. So we are putting together bit by bit these colours, and all we know is that that arrangement must work. The way it works is that the way the operation works is that one of us does the painting and one of us thinks up the colour. And there's a very strict division of labour. So the other one never does the painting. And that one who isn't the other one never thinks up the colour. And sadly, I am the monkey who does the painting. And Emma is the thought generator who thinks up the arrangements. She's a professional mosaicist, and she's been making mosaics for 20 years, and she does them for a range of commissioners, sometimes a very humble thing like a children's school, it's a mosaic on the wall, or it's a private commission, someone's bathroom is being mosaic, or it could be a mosaic on the roof of Tony Blair's house, and she has to go past the guys with machine guns outside his house because all the crimes he's committed, is one day he's going to be killed unless he has these very heavy dudes all around the square in Mayfair where he lives with guns. And Emma goes there and meets Cherie and Tony, and Cherie takes her up to the roof and says, well, we want something nice up here for when the war criminals come and socialise with us. And M says, forget it, I'm not working for you. No, she doesn't. She says, okay, I've got a good idea. I see there's some possibilities here about lights, and we could capture something here. I know I can do that with my 20 years' experience of putting colours together and creating colour vibrations. Or she does it for the swimming pool of the Spice Girls, or some sheikhs in the Arab Emirates. So she's, in all these years, she's developed a very, I think, awesome ability to make decisions about colour, which I don't think even she realised isn't all that common. To, you know, colour, people think they know what colour is, but they basically know what bright colour is. It's sort of childish bright colour that you get in pop art or in children's toys or beach towels or something. And everything, then they think there's another range which is kind of maybe more muted, that you get in Armani clothes, and that's it. Whereas really colour is relationships, it's to do with, and proportions, it's to do with one colour and another colour. A colour is only anything because of other colours that are around it. And so therefore colour is always an arrangement, because it's always to do with mental processes and perceptions. You're always seeing something in relation to another, and you're organising that, those relationships. You do it in a way that's so natural to you that you're not aware of doing it. And colourists and great artists like Van Gogh think about it. Van Gogh used to have a cardboard box with balls of coloured wool in it, and he would try out a bit of wool and put another bit of wool next to it because of something he'd looked up to do with colour theories at the time that were going on in France. So he thought, well, maybe I should do that because I see these guys, the post-impressionists, doing their pointillism. Maybe that's, I should stop doing such brown stuff. I'll do the bright colour. Where are they getting those dots from? Oh, they seem to be interested in scientific colour theories. I'll look it up myself. I'm a bit too socially unacceptable to hang out with them, otherwise they could tell me. And he gets enough ideas to enable him to do that, to do his work. And he gets enough, really, of a truly objective scientific system. Enough to make his work work. It wouldn't be enough to give a lecture on colour, and it wouldn't be enough to really further the science of colour analysis. But it was certainly enough to go with what he already knew and to create something really that we continue to be staggered by and in awe of. And there are very few people who do that. Maybe there are more people who would like to do it, but even they are very few. And then there's very few who can actually do it. And because of certain experiences that I had had as an art student, I was able to recognise when I met Em that she had this colour ability. And I don't think before then I'd ever particularly... I knew that there was such a thing as artists who took colour seriously, but I couldn't really care less about them. And then I saw, well, actually, what I was quite interested in was seriousness in art. Why not be serious about colour? And here was somebody that I know very well, in fact, my wife, who is good at it. And I thought I could... instead of struggling on doing my own paintings, which I wasn't really quite sure what they were for or what they were doing, I would get her in and to advise me. And then the minute she gave me some advice, I was shocked at how powerful the difference was. I felt that maybe I should assist her. But in any case, I thought we should collaborate on an equal footing, and we should make paintings that were reduced down merely to colour. And I found very quickly, after a couple of years, we were able to sell and get a gallery and have exhibitions. But I was aware of this process of awkward vulnerability, which I then saw her mosaic. I was able to see then, although I had never really noticed it before, that her mosaics went through this same process every time, that they were made by drawings and drawings and drawings, one after the other, overlaying with tracing paper, laying in some colours, screwing it up, laying in some colours, screwing it up, until arriving at a kind of plan that could possibly work, then laying out all the mosaic stones with the beautiful assistants who were in rock bands, and she had a lovely workshop off the Holloway Road that was incredibly impressive. It was in the early 90s. Anyway, they were all little elves helping her with the mosaic stones, and she'd lay them all, the stones, and she'd break them up, lay in different stones, be remaking it, remaking it. At no stage during that did it ever really look like anything. And then at the end, there was a sort of ripple all across, this vibrating rhythms effect, a pulse running through the whole thing, which although she wanted it, that was her aim to begin with, she couldn't possibly tell at the beginning how it could be achieved. She could only get to it by doing it. And again, I would say that is a good metaphor for how an artistic act, in terms of one artist, but also in terms of a whole life system of art, works. That rather that a sort of vague aim, or even a clear aim, but it's very narrow, how it evolves and evolves and evolves into something incredibly rich and powerful that you couldn't have predicted. And I, in some of those books that Terry mentioned earlier, I documented and chronicled my experience of those scenes developing, and in particular, the young British artist who, Richard, who's here tonight, Richard Patterson, is a sort of member of that. And, you know, it was a rather sort of loose group, but he is sort of part of that generation. But I wasn't. I was much older than those people. I'm about 10 years older than them, I think. And I'd already had a life before in art before they appeared, editing magazines and seeing what went on. So I saw the rise of those people partly as I see those paintings. It sort of seemed obvious and youthful, and you think, well, that won't last, and they're just copying stuff they see in magazines. And it's sort of imitating an art world that already exists. And then you think, wow, that'd be a good idea. Just do that, and just have the confidence in what you're doing, and arrange an exhibition, and don't worry too much. Worry a bit about the products, but accept that these are the products that you can do. Put together the exhibition, and then something, simply by virtue of you having done it, the other circumstances are ready and things will fall into place. Of course, you couldn't know when you're doing it that they would fall into place, but by a combination of a certain type of positive creativity and then a certain type of, if you like, negative chanciness, they do fall into place. When we're working on our paintings, we have enough experience of doing other paintings to know that in the end it probably will be okay. But we certainly don't know that this will be a good, really good one, or the best one. But it could only be the best one or a really good one if we do it. So we do know that there'll be two, three or four which are good and people like them, but we don't really think they're up to the high ideals that we really want for them. And in fact, we never really get that ideal. But you can only get... You know, the problem with ideals is that they are only ideals. They're incredibly intangible. So you can only realise them by doing something concrete towards the realisation. I think why I was able to see that Emma had something about her is that I identified with her being absolutely nothing to do with the art world. And there'd always been, in my sense of editing an art magazine, having been to art school, having spent many years processing and commenting upon art and culture as it was being made before me, there was always something, at least half of me, if not more, felt absolutely absent from the thing that I was engaged in. And that might have something to do with the fact that I come from a very grotesquely dysfunctional background, which meant that from a very early age I had to survive in an incredibly primitive way, so that I could never be sure that the sky wouldn't fall in or the ground fall away from under me, or that reality wasn't entirely menacing and had nothing protective or reassuring about it, that it could turn nasty at any moment. And so that I had a very sort of aggressive, defensive psychological mechanism which somehow worked to my advantage, in that I found myself editing an art magazine, having had virtually no formal education whatsoever. None of the certificates of education that you get in England did I have. The only certificate, until I got an art degree, the only certificate I had was a 200-meter swimming certificate. And then even that, I was still in that pool hours after everybody else was waiting in the coach to go back to the junior school or something. And I think I even failed the cycling proficiency test. I had nothing. And yet, by some kind of manic survival instinct and an interest in art that the one thing that I could do that others couldn't do was a sort of cartoonish type of drawing. And so I preferred to do something that I could do than something that was at all hard, like trying to educate yourself. And so I tumbled into art school and then somehow tumbled into this art magazine where I was doing a very lowly job there, putting the stamps on the subscriptions. And then I was sweeping the office a bit or managing the office. And then I was processing people's articles, which meant that I had to understand the articles. And then I had to understand a little bit about grammar and language and a headline idea and taking out the bits that didn't need to be there. And then I had to understand a bit about layout and design. And then I was selling ads. We had somebody who sold ads, but she never seemed to get the money in for them. And we didn't have very many ads. And I found that if I really phoned and fought, you got much more ads. And then if you phoned and threatened down the line about the payment, you got much more payment. So I was doing the ads and the subscriptions and I was processing the articles and I was generating articles and I was commissioning the articles. And then I was editing the magazine. And then it was only a small black and white magazine. It was about a local scene, abstract art by people I wasn't particularly interested in. So then I got some people from Texas called Pat and Jack Butler, who had made their money from Mobil Oil and were now retired. And they lived part of the time in Texas and part of the time in New York, and they had another home in Florida, but they also lived part of the time in Knightsbridge. And I asked Charles Saatchi if he would buy this magazine, ArtScribe, and make it into a swanky, colour, international, global, powerful art magazine. Because I thought that would be better than the small time thing that we had. And he thought about it for a weekend, and I thought, yeah, it's, you know. And then he said, well, sadly, no, we couldn't do that. But I'll ask around. And so he hooked us up with the Butlers, and they did buy it. And they did put in a lot of money. And so, indeed, did answer this sort of power fantasy that I had in the mid-80s of a magazine that would be like Art Forum or something, which simply didn't exist in England, which was a very parochial scene then. All the English artists wanted to do in those times was to run away to New York, where it was exciting and glamorous. And one thing led to another, and unfortunately, the Butlers had a sort of ideal, which, and I've mentioned the danger of ideals of that magazine. They thought it would be a sort of the Queen's art magazine of genteel, lovely art. And that wasn't something that I'd really ever had a taste for. Although now with age and maturity, I can see how that could be a good thing. But then I just wanted to be like the most fantastic conceptual artist and abstract expressionist and anything good that ever happened in 20th century art. I wanted this magazine to stand. That would be the place you go to find out about it. And anything hot and powerful and terrifying that was happening now in contemporary art, I wanted them to come to this magazine, ArtScribe, and look it up, which in England there wasn't such a magazine that you could do before. But unfortunately, this conflict between a sort of royal-type art magazine and a conceptual art terrifying magazine resulted in a moment of violence, the only one that I've ever experience in my life where I came out on top. But of course, the moral of the story is that don't ever hit the office manager, because although you feel at the time, well, maybe that's the right thing to do, I can tell you now, a courier will come to your flat with a message saying you needn't come in to work tomorrow. And when you quickly run around and get in there and try and steal all the files, the locks will be changed. And you suddenly realise you've got to pay the rents and the mortgage and you can't do that anymore because you haven't got a job. All just for a moment of hitting that guy. Because I told him, I was telling, Richard and Christina will have to forgive me because I told him this story last night, and it's never good to tell an anecdote so soon after you just told it. But he'd been behaving badly. He would wander out and he wouldn't pay attention, and he was sort of a... I'd got him in there. I'd got him in his job in the first place. Just like a student, you know, and he owed everything to me, really, I felt. But for some reason, he was turning against me because I was so ambitious for the magazine. I think, actually, it's possible that everyone in the office hated me because I was such a monster of ambition and I was really trying to make that thing be good. And he was very insolent. one day, and I found myself saying, if you don't do this thing, I'll hit you. And I don't know why, it was a childish thing, you know, and I don't know why, it was a stupid thing to say. And anyway, he did it again the next day, and I felt, well, if I don't hit him, he'll think I don't mean what I say. And it was almost like an automatic impulse. As I walked across, quite a big office, I walked across and I did the deed, and it just didn't feel right. I was surprised, actually, it didn't hit me back. And maybe that was the only relief that I got from it. And then all the troubles started that I've sketched in lightly then about the lack of job and your whole life falling apart. And it took me what seemed a long time, although actually considering the awfulness of the crime, it wasn't very long, before I was asked to go and work for TV, which I had no interest in doing. I didn't think TV was anything. I didn't really know the difference between the channels. Probably you don't either in England, but they have a commercial channel. They have many commercial channels, and they have one channel that is kind of run by the Queen called the BBC. And they don't have ads, and it has very high values, and they probably doesn't anymore, but in those days it did. And the news is much more truthful on the BBC. It's respected more around the world, or it's more lurid and vulgar on the other channels. And they asked me to come and, because they knew about ArtScribe, to come and be a sort of researcher. And then one thing led to another, and they realised I was good at researching. I knew about art, and they didn't. And they started this programme called The Late Show. It's a nightly culture magazine programme that lasted for an hour. And 500,000 or 1 million people would watch it, which by TV standards is not a great deal. But by art standards, an audience of 1 million or 500,000 seeing really frightening, obscure contemporary art antics on TV was quite revolutionary, and it would be even now anywhere in the world. And it wasn't that late at night. It went out at 11 o'clock at night, but it's not like 3 in the morning. It was on for an hour, and it was watched, as I say, by a lot of people. And so very quickly, I went from this, you know, my mother was a very serious manic depressive who had violently psychotic episodes that would last, it would take 2 years to recover. You know, there'd be 3 months build-up of mania where it was terrifying. She'd be taken to hospital and given an electric shock treatment, then she'd be recovering for years and years, and I wouldn't see her. And I was put in a children's home when I was 6, and I was there for 7 years, and I came out when I was an early teenager, and I got into this weird situation where I was kind of kidnapped to Toronto and arrested by the Mounties and put in a remand home in Toronto, and I was brought back to London, put in a remand home in London, and I had long hair, and I didn't really know why it existed, and I just wanted to die. But I was quite funny and always charmed and amused the situation. I was terrified when I went to the remand home. In the one in Toronto was fine, you had lovely food and you were looked after. But in the one in London, it was very vulnerable because it was populated entirely by extremely violent, resentful, gobbing skinheads. And I had this long hair and beads and T-shirt with 3 buttons down the front. And I had to really think up some good stories to make them want to hear the stories rather than see me a bloody pulp, you know. Which I was able to do. And I came out of there, and I was put in a strange, a sort of place that would never exist now, but was probably typical of some things around the world. Maybe it had roots in the Rudolf Steiner system, but it was a very sort of progressive community. It wasn't a school, you didn't do any lessons, but it was kind of a school, and you got sent there by local authorities. You were paid for if you were in trouble with the law or whatever. And if you were perceived to be a bit bright, but you were a mess, and you'd really been on the garbage heap of despair, but you were considered worth rescuing. I was sent to this place in the country, in a sort of community for maladjusted boys. And it was run by an old guru man who, there were one or two sort of customs, but there were no rules as such. You know, somebody had to cook for everybody every day, and somebody else had to wash the pots, and somebody else had to, I don't know, bring in the coal to light the heater for the cooking, and that was about it. And there was, apart from the kitchen where the heating was, there was no heating. It was a very cold and gloomy place. But you know, after a couple of years, you're considered to have had some kind of therapy, and you'd be better equipped, if not fully equipped, to adventurize your way through the rest of adult existence. And I stumbled out of there with all those problems, and in a rather unconscious way, but there must have been a steely consciousness of survival. I found myself doing all those things that I just told you until I got through all those things with the hitting and the TV, and which reminds me, I should show you some other pictures. Let's have the next picture. Oh, he's gone to sleep up there. John, give us another picture. No, okay. Well, the other pictures would have been very formal. They're very formal images of art history, which they're very interesting in a way because they're pictures that Em and I selected and put together that show, for example, circles in paintings done by Byzantine artists or paintings done by Russian revolutionaries. Oh, there's just some more details by us. So that's a detail of a painting when it's actually finished, and that shows you a very small unit. That would be maybe 6 inches high. That shows you the basic elements, sharp colour and muted colour. And the next one. And you can see that each area is treated very differently. There's a lot of layers. Sometimes an area is pure white ground and just sort of scumbled muddy colour over it. See that sort of donkey brown background ghostly colour that's the background for the steely grey colour there. But another area, like the blue next to it, there'll be a lot of layers underneath that washy pale blue. So we're coming back again and again to those sections, and each section is a kind of painterly event. Some of them are consciously repeated, and some of them are just where we're resolving difficulties in that area, and then we find that when we step back, it does repeat something else, but we hadn't intended to do it. So, but most of them are conscious, fully conscious decisions. Others are less conscious. And then sometimes we're sort of squiggling in little darker colours, which in a way imitate, these dark patches of green that have a sort of marbly effect on there. They're imitating the effect of a scumbly kind of handling there. So you've got repetitions which are imitations or rough copies, so that you're always keeping a sort of perceptual thread going. There's never a break. Something appears and then it appears, it reiterates in a near enough form so that you feel there's a continuity. I was hoping that the next pictures would be art historical ones, and maybe they'll be coming up soon. That's a painting, that's the fully finished version of what you saw just there. So we'll stay on this one for a bit. This is maybe some of you have been to Florence, and this is the ceiling in the baptistry there. It's a domed structure which has rings and rings and rings and rings that go right up to the top where there's a skylight, a circle of sky coming through. And all around it are these sort of layers of narratives. And the whole thing is a sort of pattern freak-out where the patterns, so if you look at those, that sort of pattern border of diamond shapes, and then the patterned columns, and then maybe the patterned foliage stuff, you realise that the people are made out of the same kind of patterns, or the forms that the people are made out of imitate the forms of the patterns, and vice versa. So nothing is on its own. Everything is repeating or connected to everything else. So you're looking at an endlessly undulating, evolving, multiplying set of rhythms. But it happens to be carrying a load of symbolic imagery. And the viewers at the time and the viewers right now are compelled, understandably, by the impact and power of that symbolic imagery. And because most of those viewers are not themselves artists, they don't ask themselves where the power comes from. They think it comes from the imagery. And in the days in which the work was made, and for many people now, they would think more, it doesn't just come from the imagery, it comes from God, or it comes from the Bible, or it comes from the power that those symbols represent. But the fact is that those God things and those power things are in a realm that we can't touch. That's the whole point about God and that kind of biblical stuff. Whereas art is a concrete thing. So artistic, creative design decisions went into the making of that awesome sort of wraparound golden mosaic environment in the Florence Baptistry, which is now so well preserved, that are of exactly the same order as the decisions that Em and I make in those crude arrangements of diamonds.
where we're abstracting and narrowing down and minimalizing the visual richness of something like that. And we live in an age where there's more choice about belief, about, say, religious belief. Whereas in that age, it's not a matter of choice, it's simply reality. Reality is imbued with religion, and every step of the path of life has a sort of religious aspect to it. So you don't sort of, it's not a lifestyle choice. And it's not even a situation where you'd think, well, there are some people who don't have this religion. You would think that there are some people who have the wrong religion, but you wouldn't think there are places where there isn't even any religion. You might think that the infidels and the non-believers, effectively they didn't have religion simply by having the wrong one. But the travellers amongst the Westerners who'd seen Islamic mosques would see that those mosques were as staggeringly visually impactful as their own cathedrals. And that symbolic imagery type of decoration was matched in Islamic cathedrals by a purely abstract type of decoration. But there really was an equality between them, and indeed they were often made by the same people. So Byzantine craftsmen would be hired to come out from Constantinople, from the Christian Empire in the East, to go and do work in the West. And even they would be hired by Islamic caliphs or Islamic lords of Islamic empires to make Islamic decorations. So Christian-believing mosaic craftsmen would be hired by non-Christian religious leaders to decorate the mosques. You're looking at the floor of the baptistry there. They've got, again, a multiplication of rhythms. Each individual section, you can see clearly what the organisation principle is. Although they are sort of delightfully unpredictable, each section. You don't really know whether the red triangle or the black triangle is going to fall in the diamond shapes there. And then they're all like sewn together in this dazzling multiplication. And if you go on a bit, there's a bit of sand, and there's the wall of a building, and they're both in Norfolk somewhere. And we're interested in the organisation that goes on anywhere, and goes on anyway in the environment, since we're all organising creatures, and we can't help but be that. And if you run through the next few images, if you stop here, this is the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. That's when they had the scaffolding out because they were restoring some of the mosaics. And this is a lift in Istanbul. So it's just an old 1960s grid or something. And then there's a fantastic light coming through all the piercings in the Hagia Sophia, all the amazing, the way that the Hagia Sophia is like a sort of gigantic light box. And then the scaffolding is breaking up that light. So you've got this incredible, dazzling web of light and dark. And that's, for us, those are sort of visual highlights that are there almost by accident, which are matched by the very formal version that you see in the mosaic that I just showed you of all the scenes of the Bible. And we want to match with our paintings. So then if you go on next. Now, if you stay on each of these for a couple of seconds and just show me each of these. So there's some circles, and there's a Frank Stella in there, Rodchenko, David Braque, Bosch, Adolf Gottlieb, Piero della Francesca, ancient Greek plate, Matisse, Jules Zelitsky. I think that's a mosaic dome in a Byzantine temple. That's on the island of Torcello off of Venice. So you've got you've certainly got 1,000 years worth of art there, where you see the same organising principle. Because we want to experience structure, and we can't help not having it. And structure always involves repetition. So we're doing a sort of speeded up version of repetition. We're taking a lot of things away, like colour, for example, just to show you structure. And then you've got eyes by New Guinea islanders, and by Picasso, and by Goya, and by Brancusi. You've got a sort of grid pattern of organic forms by Miro, by William Morris, by ancient Rome, well, not ancient Rome, sort of first or second century AD Roman mosaicist, and then early Christian paintings in the catacombs in Rome, and then 5th century mosaics in Ravenna, all doing a sort of all-over organisation, like a bit like a Jackson Pollock grid, and so on and so on. If you go on to the next one, so this is the last picture I'm going to show you. So where we, me and Em did a lot of reducing with those pictures, taking certain things away, isolating, in order to point out structural elements and repetition and variation, reducing everything down to satisfying visual structures. Where we did that to the history of art, we do that in our paintings. And what we're looking for is something that has the unpredictability and shakiness and changeability of the story that I just told you about my odd life, and which I also told you about the odd, unpredictable, eccentric causes of an established, powerful scene in art that I witnessed but wasn't part of. I was a sort of chronicler of it, but it wasn't really anything to do with me, other than that I made programs about it or wrote articles about it, because I was interested in, I could identify with it, but I knew it wasn't me. Those people were younger than me and they have a different aesthetic maybe. I'm interested in quite abstract art, and there are very few, although Damien Hirst's spot paintings I very much admire, I don't think that his whole career could be summed up by those spot paintings. They're just one aspect of what he does, and a lot of what he does has to do with an image that has a kind of advertising power. But I could see that a very powerful, established, awesome thing could come out of a lot of sort of nonsense and silliness, which basically is most of our lives. You know, it's just the sort of trivia that we makes up most of existence. But it doesn't actually take much for that, for the sort of contingent and the fugitive and the essentially meaningless to gel into something that seems important and has the sort of contribution to make. It'll never be fixed for eternity, because all that art historical stuff I just showed you has had its day, and it's powerful, so we look back on it and they become standards and measurements of quality and achievement, and they're kind of inspiring because they have something universal and timeless about them. But of course, a lot of what they have has passed. You know, it doesn't have that power anymore. So you can only, you know, we want something that has no really final fixed pattern or image. That's why I'm perfectly happy just to show you details and not the whole thing, and sometimes show you the whole thing. We want something that changes and is fugitive and is different every time you come back to it, but in which you can see something like the elements that make up an individual life, and that also make up a successful community scene, where something is produced, something seems important, it has an impact, and it kind of raises the bar for fulfillment of existence for everybody else, if only briefly. But in the end, they're just they're quite reduced. Abstract paintings, abstract art is an esoteric type of art. It doesn't seem to be for everybody. It seems to require a lot of foreknowledge and thinking and research into the history of art. And we accept that while we might have limited success with these things, and while they mean a lot to us, they'll never really have the power of the YBAs or of the artists whose work is in the museum here, because they are about a different sort of set of concerns. But at the moment, we think the concerns that they are about, the sort of refined, visual, structured event, we think of that as sort of critical of this present moment. And that's the sort of narrative that we tell ourselves anyway to reassure ourselves. So thank you for putting up with a rather rambling talk. We've actually... We've gone past the hour, so you're welcome to go home now and forget about all this. But if any of you would like to ask a question, I'd be happy to answer it. It would have to be quick, though, because our time is officially up. Sorry, was that... Yes. Shout it out so everyone can hear.
I was wondering about the rhythm and whether the rhythm reflects incidents in your own life or reflects your life experiences. And if so, how will your trip to Texas inform the rhythm of your future work?
Well, that's a very good question. I can tell you that it does reflect my life experience because of all my judgments. But don't forget, it's a joint practice, so Emma's judgments as well. My judgments are about how I put on the paint and how I animate the colour decisions that Emma has made. She gives me a lump of colour, and then I have to get that on the canvas and animate it so it seems to have some life. But my judgments about whether it has life or not are partly to do with Emma saying, oh, that's too active, or conversely, that's too flat. You know, so maybe dye that down a bit. So with that one, make it more exciting so something can come through of the colour underneath. Those judgments that we are making, they are objective. They're about an object that we are making. But our sense of sensitivity about them, whether they're working or not, is informed very, very significantly so, and in a tangible way, by our life experience. But it's not that in the blue colours you see our sadness and in the red ones our happiness, or in the paintings I do after this, a bright colour shows my joy at your lovely faces, which I'll never forget. Or conversely, the grey was my fear at the beginning of being able to remember what I was going to say. It's not literal like that. But I think you'll find that any type of art which is essentially improvised, but in the end it's got to be a solid, believable object. I think you'll find that anybody's answer would be similar to what I've just given. That unless, you know, especially when it's abstract, where nothing is actually depicted, the whole element of depiction is taken away. You know, we might want to convey the effects of light, but we're not actually depicting light. We're making colour act as if it were light, or have a sort of vibrating effect that light has, it's a metaphor for what light does. We feel sometimes handling is dull, sometimes it's crass, sometimes it's right, but it's not. It might be right somewhere else, but maybe not for here. And those are decisions that they're sort of decisions of taste in a way that are informed by life experience. So it was a lovely question that you asked, but I'm afraid my answer is a bit tortured and not necessarily satisfying for your... Yes, that was another hand. So many of you asking questions. Oh, but that's Terry. Yeah, you're just helping me out in case I think no one wants to know.
I'm very curious, and I can ask at dinner, but I thought it might be useful for everybody else to hear your answer. I'm wondering about, I think it kind of follows this question about it reflecting your life, but also I'm wondering if you think that... I know that you're kind of self-deprecating, so you may not agree that these are successful paintings, but we know they are because there's much written about the fact that you generally sell out every show. So if that's in any way signals success, then we know they're successful paintings. Do you think that that is a byproduct of the fact that you and Emma come to this with such seriousness and you're so honest, it's such an honest endeavor? Do you think that, I mean, is that just... is there anything to that? Do you think that reflects in the visual, in the result, the manifestation of the paint?
I think the works are probably bought because they are decoratively highly achieved, which is, as you know, that's a sort of complicated thing to say, because the decorative isn't a value at the moment in art. So if one were to say they told you something ethical about society, that would be a different thing. Everyone would clap. But if you say they're decoratively very serious, it's confusing. But I think that is why they're bought. And I think they're bought by the wealthy, because only the wealthy can buy art. And they're bought... probably on a whim, you know, they think that will look good in my chalet in the south of France. It's a skiing chalet, and it costs $160,000 for anyone to stay there for a week. And they probably should have some abstract art on the walls. We'll have that. And that's... Oh, we met, that is one guy. We met another guy. They tend to be hedge funders, bankers, a guy who's the head of Sotheby's. There's a scandal about Barclays Bank at the moment, and there's a scandal about the Royal Bank of Scotland. Both those banks have our stuff. Sometimes we met them. They never say, oh, it's great to meet you, because I wanted to ask you, why did you paint that triangle brown? They don't really want to meet us. And they're quite blasé. And we're amazed, you know, that someone's bought us stuff, and we're delighted. But there's nothing to say. So I can't really answer the question, because I don't really know why they do it. And I'm just fantasizing and imagining about their motives. The chalet story is true, because he kindly sent us photos showing what they did. And we looked up the chalet, and we didn't know anything even cost that much just to stay for a skiing holiday.
Okay, so the scammers buy your work because they can afford it.
They think it looks nice. I don't think they go into what... I was talking about... Basically, I was telling you, what does it mean for something to look nice all through that talk? But I was talking about it in a rather strangulated way, because when we discuss it amongst ourselves, me and Em, we're thinking, okay, you've got to make this colour work right here. And then every now and again, we think about the meta... discussion about that discussion. We think, well, what does it mean for something to look nice? Why would anyone want it to be? What does it have to do with ordinary people's lives? And how do we? What is a structure? Is it society structured, or is vision structured? Or when I look out at the random blotches of colour that make up what I'm seeing here, am I able to put all the patches into information about people because of some scientific thing to do with structure? And we think yes. And, you know, that's cavemen had to sort of... You know, there's something to do with the evolution of mankind that has to do with perception. And in order to defend your vulnerable self against the weather and the monster animals and hunt the meat and everything, you had to be able to see long distances, and you had to be there quickly, and your reflexes had to be ready. So you've got you have a very, very evolved visual system. It's highly complex. So... what art does is celebrate and make a sort of joyous occasion out of that mechanism, which is a natural survival mechanism. You find that, as with other things that are natural to do with survival or to do with society's, to do with basic requirements of society, the art does a sort of celebrating. And it halts you for a moment and makes you think about those aspects of existence. But probably previously, it would say it's the god of seeing. Or it's the god of storms we're appeasing. Or we're making all the gods be delighted by having some games in their honour. And why not have some marble statues as well in their honour? And put some rose petals or sacrifice a lamb under it. And so now we take all those things have gone away, but we have the marble statue. We don't have the marble statue because of different technology. So we have a mess on the floor, or an installation, or a video, or a painting, or something startling, or, you know, which is called art. And then in our case, we do something simply that looks nice. And so when that thing is consumed, i.e. somebody buys it, I doubt, and maybe this is also the case with more complicated conceptual art, I doubt if the consumer is racking their brains with intellectual justifications of why they're buying it. And I doubt that, because I think in the encounters that I've had with one or two buyers, they simply don't seem like that's the way they carry on, that they're not going around questioning everything or wondering why they do things. They're simply doing it instinctively. I think they used to be in the culture of modern art, and in the culture of postmodern art maybe, and maybe in earlier cultures of art certainly, there probably were people who were involved with art who weren't themselves makers of it, but were sort of philosophers of it and did think about it. And there are certainly philosophers now, but they don't tend to philosophize our type of art, or they put it in a certain category, a negative category, of called medium specificity or formalism, or a look of art that existed maybe in the 1970s and hasn't been taken seriously since. So, yes.
Okay, you talked a lot about unpredictability today. How are you consciously putting unpredictability into these like systems and layers? And I know it's the dual practice.
Oh, well, the painting. Well, no, the paintings are very much about expectation and surprise, or repetition and variation. So you feel that there will be another orange because you've seen repetition. You're not really analysing it intellectually, but your eye is thinking this. But you don't really know where the orange will fall. It is falling roughly where it might be, but it's not where the brown is, where the greeny brown is. The greeny brown is where the greeny brown is. So then suddenly you're thinking about, well, where is another greeny brown? So you're getting used to a configuration of oranges and thinking everything else is to do with making the oranges look good. But then you start to look at one of the other things, and then you realize that the greeny brown has its own configuration. Maybe the orange is only there to support the greeny brown one. Then you realize that each of those things is its own pulse. But you don't know exactly where. You know, it's an uneven pulse. Overall, it's sort of more or less regular. But if you actually checked out each incident of the upbeat or the downbeat or whatever words you want to use, they don't land where you would necessarily expect them to. They're just somewhere in that rectangle. But they're near enough to each other for it to feel like repetition, but far away enough or not regular enough for it to feel like a surprise. But if it's too surprising, with the type of formal inquiry that we do, a kind of visual dullness results. If it's too unpredictable. If it's too predictable, a different type of dullness results. So our task is to make something that has a structural balance. If you all sat too close to each other, it wouldn't be so nice. If you sat, unless we were much younger, but if you sat too far away, there would be certain limitations to that as well. It wouldn't be like a crowd. You wouldn't be all together. We're all communing, you with each other slightly, me very sort of strenuously telling you things. You're receiving the vibe from me and I'm getting it from you. We're about how as close to each other as we want to be. But there is a certain rhythm to it. And there's some gaps in the seats. Why didn't they come? Where are they? Or there's enough repetition, you know. So that's, we want that type of structure in the painting. We don't want a hysterical, mad structure. And we don't want a boring, rigid structure. We want a structure that seems like life. And I would say that the sort of casualness of this is a bit like the light and the branches of those photos that I showed earlier on this evening. So it's that kind of life experience, as well as our own autobiographical experience, me and M's autobiographical experience, which is the repetition and unpredictability that I'm talking about. It's not so much the psychology of two people making a painting, although there is another story about the psychology, the weirdness of having to obey, one person having to obey another one, and that other person not really doing the thing that she's making the me do. So she's got to believe in what I do, or else not believe it and make me do it differently. But she isn't me, so it's, if you're in a band, which I have been, although it wasn't very good, of course, you've realised that you do a little riff on a guitar, but then you say to the guitarist, do that riff. But they can't really do that. They can do something much better, but not that. And to do that would be very constraining for them. It wouldn't be so good. So you've got to ride a sort of bit of a wildness and make it, and then lots of little bits of wildness, and make them all exist in a mesh of equal but slightly different wildnesses. So there's something overall that's believable and that has a constant changeability to it. Yes?
Just following up on what you were saying, are you made any of the decisions involved in the painting?
Well, it's very stressful, the relationship. It's very, very difficult to work with somebody else. I think anyone who works with somebody else in something creative or even not will know that it can be stressful. But our arguments are not about aesthetics, really. We trust each other's. It says, oh, we're roped together anyway. No, you know, no, maybe we don't trust each other, but we say that we do. So we tend to argue about trivial things. I think that's where we probably are arguing about something important, but I think we're afraid to argue about the important things in case it goes too wrong. So we argue about what records are playing or who made the tea. Or very rarely do I say, I just don't think that's the right colour. And very often M says that's not the right handling, but that's part of our agreement. Very rarely does she really get cross, feel frustrated with the sort of conduits that I am, in a way. In the making of the shapes, I've got to be a sort of conduit for her plans and schemes. So we argue, but I don't think they're significant arguments. And I've met Gilbert and George a few times, and I think they work in the same way, that they know each other's limitations and talents, and it is a sort of successful double act. There's a third force is made out of the two. I think that's the same with us. That usually has to happen in a group effort, otherwise the group falls apart, whether it's a musical group or an art group. It's very rare for, incidentally, we should stop now because we have to go, but it's very rare for there to be a painting group, because painting is so much, or I believe, anyway, in my experience, painting tends to be a lot about touch and sort of rather sort of subtle things that it's quite difficult for a group to do. And that's why we have such a strict division, that... Also, I have limitations. I can't really think up the colours that she can think up. And Em hasn't had the experience of painting that I've had. So there's a simple reason for it, but also there's a complicated reason that we think, well, what does a painter need? It needs certain faculties. We have some of them. We're going to make a sort of Frankenstein monster out of our bits, out of our separate bits. So I must send you all away now, because you should have gone 10 minutes ago or 20 minutes ago.